Hello everybody, this is Salil Tripathi from the Institute for Human Rights and Business, and I'm in conversation with Anita Ramashastri. She is a professor of law at the University of Washington, and she is part of the UN Working Group for Business and Human Rights and an accomplished scholar on many of the issues related to corporate accountability. So thank you for joining us, Anita. You're of course our senior fellow as well, and it'll be good to have a quick chat about the remedy issue. So my first question for you is, can you tell us about both the work that the UN Working Group has done and Office of High Commission of Human Rights' own accountability and remedy project, and how they might inform future discussion around remedy?
I'll start first actually with the Office of the High Commissioner's project, because it's a multi-year project focused on accountability and remedy, and really looking at all of the different ways in which victims of corporate human rights abuses can seek access to remedy. Mm-hmm. So including state-based judicial mechanisms, and now currently non-judicial mechanisms, and then of course potentially in the future looking at company-level, operational-level grievance mechanisms. And so the nature of that project is really to provide very practical guidance, especially to states, around what are the key obstacles, both, you know, legal, but as well as in terms of practical, to lawsuits and to criminal prosecutions, and also to other kinds of non-judicial remedies. Because, of course, the big issue for everyone is we have the UN guiding principles, but we continue to have the larger problem that victims internationally aren't able to seek redress and recourse effectively. So right. The High Commissioner's project is very much about sort of practical tools and steps and guidance. And so I think it's an ambitious but a very good project. As mm-hmm. a parallel and companion to that, the UN Working Group has taken on a couple of issues. My colleague Surya Deva, who's currently the chair, recently presented a report to the UN General Assembly on really what does effective remedy look like in the context of business and human rights. There's a lot of work in the human rights community around what victims' right to a remedy in international law. So he's been trying to focus on what is effective remedy for business and human rights. To the extent that a company's involved, what could they provide? Everything from apologies and restitution to damages, right? So looking at remedy broadly, he speaks of a bouquet of remedies, and also the idea of a victim-centered approach to remedy, as well as thinking about remedy from the very beginning. The guiding principles really talk about due diligence and prevention, so thinking about remedy from sort of day one. In addition, I've been leading the work stream that focuses on more the criminal aspect. The High Commissioner's done a little bit of work on this, but we've taken it forward, focusing on cross-border cooperation. So many of the cases that we're trying to deal with in this area really relate to harms that occur potentially actually more than one country if there's cross-border issues, and then companies and subsidiaries that may be located in multiple places. So law enforcement has to cooperate. There's a lot of people have focused on the Trafigura case, right, mm-hmm. which involved a company from Europe, but, you know, dumping that happened in the Cote d'Ivoire. So the question is, yeah. How does law enforcement gather evidence, et cetera? So we presented a report last June to the Human Rights Council on very practical steps that governments can be taking to prosecute these cases. I'll just conclude my comments on this part of what's the UN doing, just to say that what we discovered, which I think we're chatting about today, is there's been very little criminal prosecution, that governments have been reluctant. But what we found is that in areas that relate to business and human rights, so in areas of human trafficking, corruption, mm-hmm. Prosecution of environmental crimes, you know, involving things like illegal timber or logging, there's actually a lot of practice out there. So that in areas that implicate corporations that have kind of a human rights dimension, you know, the illegal logging trade, for example, certainly has involved harm to humans, not just to trees.
Yes.
That because of underlying legal frameworks like treaties, and mechanisms, formal and informal, that have been set up, that things work well. And on the area of war crimes and international law, there are war crimes units in many major countries. So the frameworks and the practices actually exist. It's just that we haven't applied them very directly to kind of classic business and human rights cases.
Right. And if we do, it's just staying on the criminal part. I mean, if we stay on the issue of the scenario of criminal prosecutions against companies for their adverse impacts, the record has not been very encouraging in the sense of, you know, if the yardstick you're measuring with is convictions. Now, yeah. This is just to understand why. Is it prosecutorial reluctance? Is it a case of the cases being much harder to initiate, evidence being harder to get and all that? Or are there other hindrances, including the lack of political will?
Yes. Well, I would say, of course, the biggest one is lack of political will. Even underpinning that, I think, is just some larger structural issues, which is that many of these cases, again, because, you know, national prosecutors that are sitting in capitals in, let's say, Europe or North America, aren't necessarily going to be thinking about what's happening with their subsidiaries or joint venture partners somewhere halfway around the world. So these cases get to prosecutors because civil society groups, locally or globally, will have evidence and publish reports and then will bring information to prosecutors. So improving the way in which civil society interacts with prosecutors is a very key part of this, mm-hmm. and also just sort of learning what kind of evidence is sufficient. But then just the cross-border issue of what's the case for why you want to investigate and spend resources on these kinds of transnational cases, and, mm-hmm. and sort of how does one make it a priority? In the area of corruption, we've made it a priority globally. The question is, I think we're now on the cusp of potentially, especially with this sort of greater emphasis in the world on supply chains and labor trafficking, maybe we're at that place now. Right. Can I digress just for a second to say, you know, you and I have worked together for many years, and of course, my research goes back to World War II, where through the Nuremberg and the Far East tribunals, we saw very clearly, especially in times of war or conflict, that business does get implicated in serious human rights violations. When I started doing my research, I mean, I looked back to World War II, but looking forward, of course, when I started looking at business and human rights, the whole area of business and human rights really grew out of conflicts around the late 1990s. We had Sierra Leone with diamonds, we had DRC and companies engaged in this.
Sudan and so on, absolutely.
Sudan. So, I mean, that was a classic area where we saw potential criminal implication. But again, as you're saying, what happened as a result? We had civil lawsuits more than we had criminal prosecutions.
Right.
But I'll just point out, in the past, let's say, month or few weeks, we've actually had a couple of things that have happened. One is in Brazil, with respect to the Samarco Fundão Dam, that we have Brazilian prosecutors saying that cases against individual company representatives from BHP, Billiton, Vale, and also Samarco, the dam, you know, operating venture, can go ahead. And it includes potential indictments against both local executives, but a few overseas as well. It doesn't involve war crimes. It's about sort of the largest dam disaster in Brazil's history. But, you know, again, it's showing that we have these issues haven't gone away.
Mm-hmm.
We also have investigations going in Europe, France, with respect to Lafarge Construction Company, with respect to whether they
in Syria, you know,
again, the company, paid to keep the cement plant operating under ISIS control. And so, you know, again, you have in two different jurisdictions these issues. And then I don't know what's happened, but I know that with respect to Sweden's Lundin Petroleum, there have been allegations with respect to their activities. The issue is still alive. The question is, are we at a place where there'll be more action?
Yeah, but one thing that's not, I'm not saying it is slipping through the door or falling between the stools, but one issue that doesn't get addressed, and I think, again, it goes back to the political will question, frankly, is the issue of domestic jurisdiction and domestic prosecution. Because, yes, this focuses on transnational nature of the crimes, but as you know, and I know, and everybody who works in this field knows, many of the abuses take place domestically involving large or even small domestic corporations. And I think for that, we certainly need to think of a creative way, I would guess, to make sure that home governments themselves, or host governments rather, but they are in home and it's in their own territory and own turf, start addressing that responsibility more seriously. So it is, of course, the Pillar 3, but also Pillar 1.
Well, I think there's two things to that, right? So one is that Brazil is sort of a large but, you know, transitional economy, is a host government, right?
Yes.
So it's interesting to see that those, again, a prosecution potentially there. So Brazil and another country, Argentina, that's been dealing with actually the legacy of the dirty wars with respect to companies that may have been implicated in deaths of trade unionists and others. So I think, number one, we shouldn't give up on host states, right? That's also important. But back to home states, again, let me reiterate that I think that one area that may help us understand how to make the case better is the area of labor trafficking. So we can see kind of how to deal with it in that case that may give governments more comfort to deal with others.
Mm-hmm.
But my cross-border report with the working group really illustrated another piece, which is that there are these related areas, right, environmental crimes and most importantly, bribery and corruption, where very often where there's an underlying criminal act that implicates a corporation, there's probably something else going on too. And
mm-hmm.
corruption is one of those areas. So one of the things that we're encouraging states to think about is in areas where they already have an ability to prosecute corporate crimes, so an environmental unit or anti-corruption unit, that they should consider the human rights impact of that underlying crime as a reason to prosecute, right? So that even if it's money laundering, right, if the money laundering led to a substantial human rights harm to people, that that should give them a real sense that they need to prosecute. So, you know, I was on a panel at the UN Forum with a former investigator for the FBI who just said to the crowd, of course, remember that Al Capone was the gangster, right, was prosecuted for tax evasion.
Tax violation, absolutely.
So when you say we need to get creative, I think that's one of the ways we need to get creative is what are the other crimes? Trafficura, the prosecution was for violation of an environmental law in the Netherlands that, that led to any kind of enforcement. And I'll just mention one last thing, which that in addition to the work of the working group, the International Corporate Accountability Roundtable and Amnesty International partnered together to create something. Well, they commissioned an independent panel of experts. I co-chaired this with retired Justice Ian Binney from Canada. And we came up, again, with very practical corporate crimes principles for prosecutors and governments, which is meant to sort of give them some more ways of thinking about that home state prosecution. So, again, it's another tool.
And we've written about it in the text accompanying this podcast. So thank you for noting those as well. Yeah. Thanks very much, Anita, and good luck with all your work.